Are you sick of hearing about AI, how it will revolutionize the workplace? Here is a concerning paradox. As much hype as there is surrounding AI, TSI research is revealing that technology companies are actually failing to deploy impactful AI use cases that are within reach today. What is it going to take to change that reality? I'm Tom Slaw, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today I will be joined by Ron Green, a longtime veteran in the world of AI. He's the co-founder and CTO of Kung Fu AI. We will be discussing the current state of AI adoption and tactics companies can employ to accelerate their adoption of AI use cases with massive ROIs. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Ron, welcome. It's great to see you again. Second time we've met. And I got to start here. I have to ask this. Where did the name Kung Fu AI come from? It takes me back to the cartoon I used to watch when I was a kid on Saturday morning, man.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
There we go.
First off, we wanted something provocative, something that would be memorable. And I think we got that. We hear it's really kind of funny. Even when we were brand new, like 7 years ago, I'd bump into people and there was no way they had heard of us yet. And I would tell them, we're with Kung Fu AI. And every now and then I would have somebody say, oh, yeah, we heard of you. And we hadn't even done any marketing yet. Yeah. But the other part of it is that in Mandarin, it actually translates like literally to a skill achieved through hard work. And, as an AI services company, building production grade AI systems is really, really hard. And we thought it was kind of reflective of the amount of effort, all of the engineers have put in, both educationally, professionally, to get to where they are today.
Yeah, cool. It's a fun story. So let's for the audience here who might not have heard of Kung Fu AI yet, can you just overview the types of services you provide to your customers?
Yeah, so we're an AI strategy and engineering firm. We focus exclusively on artificial intelligence and have done so since our founding 7 years ago. So what does that mean? That means we help companies adopt and implement artificial intelligence solutions. We provide everything from sort of AI strategy development and roadmaps to custom AI model development, design, training, deployment, and management.
Perfect. And then again, you said you started about 7 years ago? Is that what you said?
Yeah, 2017.
Okay, so you started like right before all this stuff really hit the fan in terms of like general, more public acknowledgement of what's going on.
Right.
And first time you and I met, you said that you lived through this AI winter of the late 90s. I think it was the last one. Mm-hmm. And so now we have all this energy, hype, investment, all this stuff. What is different about AI today? And why would you, assert that you don't think there's going to be another winter? Because there's got to be something different here.
Yeah, that's a great question. And there really is something different. And the short summary is that when the first computers were invented in the late 30s, early 40s, it was really soon after that some of the leading academics and researchers at the time had this idea of leveraging them to do things that would be intelligent, more than just cranking through numbers. And there was this idea that maybe they could use them to play chess or recognize photos and things like that. And the challenge was the excitement was for a long time, decades ahead of the reality. And so there have been two major collapses within the research and investment of AI over the last 80 years. There was one in the early 70s, one in the 90s. They're both called the first and second AI winter. And they were, I think, deservedly reductions in AI investment and research, because the prototypes, the things that we could do back then in the 90s, they were just sort of glimmers of the future, but they weren't real. We weren't ready yet. We didn't have the compute. We didn't have the data. And the reality was, even back then when we were training, neural networks, we weren't positive we were on the right path, right? Because there were theoretical constraints that could have legitimately prevented us from getting to where we are now. And the reason there won't be a third AI winter is that these AI systems now can do things at a human or superhuman level. And I'm sure we'll talk about a bunch of this. But once you have AI systems that can generate photorealistic images or summarize text or write poetry or music or diagnose cancer, and I could go on and on and on, You're not going to walk away from that. This is a serious sea change in our capabilities. And it's actually even more than that, in that unlike anything we've ever seen before with positive feedback loops, like if you think about like social networks, the more people in a network, the more valuable that social network is. Or if you think about things like computer chips, where you can use the previous generation computer chips to help design and build the next generation of computer chips. Those are different than what we're seeing in AI, because the AI that we're developing right now can be used to train the next generation of AI. It can literally have this positive feedback loop on itself. And so I'm very confident we're done with the AI winters.
So Ron, I'm not the AI technologist, but I just want to play back what I heard there because I'm intellectually curious here. It sounds like there were two inflection points that have really enabled this next round of AI, one being compute power and just more of it and cheaper, and the other just being this massive amount of data that is being really created by this online world, this connected world. Is that fair, that those are sort of the two engines that help feed these AI models today?
That's absolutely right. I mean, there are other things, like there are some algorithmic advances for sure. But if you had to say, what are the top two by a very, very large margin, it is the fact that we have the compute and the data. On the compute side, you know, in the 90s, you know, you were dealing with the, like, what, 200 megahertz machines. You know, we're orders of magnitude beyond that in many ways when you look at the GPU compute capabilities, many orders of magnitude, in fact. Interestingly enough, on the data side, I think we thought we were closer than we were. We're many, many, many orders of magnitude, like, you know, dozens of orders of magnitude larger there. And both of those together have really made the difference, combined with those sort of algorithmic changes that we mentioned. So it's funny, I look back and like, we've really been on the right path for the last 30 years. We just were a little ahead of the hardware and the data.
Well, you know, what's super interesting is, so we wrote a book, God, years ago, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years ago, called Consumption Economics. And it was about the prediction of how IT, enterprise IT models were going to change and be much more consumption driven. In other words, customers are going to pay for what they're using, which that is becoming a much more predominant pricing model and usage model, as you know, in tech. But one phrase that we had in that book, we made this comment about the data piling up in the corner. And what we were observing is, even, you know, 10 plus years ago, a lot of these SaaS companies, et cetera, they had this telemetry on their customers, but they weren't doing much with it, right? It was piled up in the corner. Some of the data was crappy because they weren't really paying attention to their telemetry. And now the one thing I have noticed over just the last 3 years with companies leaning into AI is they're like, oh my God, this data is valuable. I got to clean it up. I got to get more of it from my product teams. You know, it's like this complete mentality shift on how data is gold. It's always been gold. But I think these AI models just take it to a whole new level of really the ROI you can extract from that data in a way that you couldn't, you know, X amount of years ago.
And that's absolutely true. I couldn't agree more, because the data was always valuable and you could maybe mine it and look for insights and analyze it and try to use it for decision making and maybe even, you know, product development prioritization. But what you couldn't do is build intelligent systems from it, right? That just wasn't possible. And so now we're seeing things like, we're seeing some of our clients are taking data sets that go back 30 years. Wow. So for example, we helped one of our clients take 30 years of real estate data and build an auto valuation model to, you know, automatically price homes. And, you know, that's across the entire continental United States. That would have just been utterly impossible just 8 years ago.
Yeah. And that's an example, again, I think, and we've talked about these types of use cases and technology before, but again, like you're saying, so data, let's say I'm doing revenue analysis and I'm looking at deal data and I look at it and I say, well, maybe I can do some predictive models or whatever to get some sense. But now I can feed that into some type of machine learning model and it's going to improve and give me insights that I didn't even have before. And the same thing like with this real estate pricing. You're going to put it into a model that's going to come up with pricing recommendations that would have been impossible for a human being, you know, using some type of standard BI tool to come up with the answer.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a game changer. And what I'd love to sort of introduce the audience to is the first time we spoke, because, you know, you have a wide, your firm works with really a wide range of companies, not just classic, you know, B2B enterprise tech companies like we do. So there's a lot of projects that you had your finger in. And I don't want to talk about B2B enterprise in a second, but you know, describe some of the most impactful AI projects mm-hmm. you guys have been involved with, just to, you know, sort of set the table for folks.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the ones I'm most proud of are, we have a model that we developed that's at the FDA right now going through the approval process. And this model can predict breast cancer risk 5 years in the future at an amazingly high accurate level. And what's really interesting about this is, most of the time when I talk to people about this, they think I'm talking about detecting cancer. But it's even more amazing than that. There are many, many companies out there that have developed breast cancer detection models. And so you can take a mammogram, run it through a computer vision AI model, and it can, using visual cues, locate and isolate signs of cancer. What's really amazing about the cancer risk prediction model I'm talking about is that there is no cancer in these mammograms. If you showed them to a radiologist, they would give the women all clear. They'd say, come back in a year. And this research came out of a joint venture between some hospitals and academia. And the amazing thing about this is, the model is a computer vision model. It is looking at the mammograms. It is accurately assessing women's risk of cancer, picking up on biological visual clues, and we don't know what they are. Yeah. We've done all kind of ablation studies. We've done analysis. We can tell where the model is looking. We can see and have it show us where it's focusing, and it's really just kind of spread out across it. And the amazing thing about this is that this model was able to do things like detect race, high blood pressure, a bunch of other things that we never told it to predict. And so we purposely had to prevent the model from being able to detect these things, because you don't want to have these spurious correlations.
Right.
And the amazing thing is, there are all the existing standard out there that is used right now for breast cancer risk assessment, the Tyrer-Cuzick metric, is known by the creators to have racial and ethnic biases, because the data set it was trained on, you know, 30-something years ago, skewed really strongly towards certain demographics.
Oh, interesting.
And this model does not have that limitation because it was trained on data from around the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so, I mean, there's a couple things that I have to react to there. One just being, again, we're talking about models that can see around corners in ways that the best radiologist or doctor could not, because
that's
they can look at so many variables and uncover patterns that, again, a person on their own is just not going to be able to do. So, and
that's exactly right.
And that use case goes on again and again and again, whether it's in the field of medicine, whether it's in business, et cetera. The other thing I just have to comment on, because I'm watching, you know, myself included, but, you know, my peer professionals, I think it is a little daunting when you look at these models and, you know, there's all this data that goes in, and they started to come out with answers that you could never see. And it is the proverbial black box,
right?
It is like you're sitting there going, whoa, like, and how do I reverse engineer how it got that answer? And you tell me, I mean, I think often it's going to be like, hey, like, you don't do the complete reverse engineering because it's just way too complex. How do you come to terms with that?
No, it's a great question. And there's a lot of interesting aspects of that question, really. One of the things I tell people is, we're surprisingly, as humans, actually kind of used to this already. Like, when we look at a photo, and imagine somebody shows you a photo of a cat, you instantly know it's a cat.
You don't know why.
And if I asked you why you knew it was a cat, no matter what you said, if you said, well, you know, the cat has pointed ears, well, I could show you a picture with, you know, the cat's head turned, or, you know, its tail or its fur or whatever. Doesn't matter. It's easy to show humans pictures of cats that violate any assumptions they make. And it's because we have this sort of incredibly powerful visual cortex, and we have this capability to detect catness, even if we can't articulate it, even if we can't explain it. And so that, you know, kind of goes back to the AI winter question. That's one of the reasons we won't go back, is because we finally have a technology where we can do things at a level that is as powerful in some regards as our own brain. We're just getting started. That said, you know, The dominant approach within AI right now is a technique called supervised learning, where you show a model some input, and in the beginning, the model just makes a random guess if it's a prediction model, but you have to know what the right answer is and you tell it.
Yep.
And you repeat this process enough and the model will learn to generalize. So for example, if you were going to try to build a model, a computer vision model to identify photos of cats, you can't show it every cat in every possible scenario. You don't have to. You show it enough, it learns to generalize and it can identify cats. That is fine for that use case, even if we can't explain it. There are use cases where that's not acceptable. So for example, if I'm building a loan decisioning model and the model just rejects somebody, I don't think that's okay. I think you need to have explainability. And so in those instances, you can lean harder on the explainability into the spectrum, and you can have models, if they're designed correctly, provide you that explainability as a part of it. You can't do that always, and it's one of the big challenges we're working on right now. But, you know, again, we're at the early stages. We will, in the not too distant future, have this powered coupled with explainability. They're not mutually exclusive.
So let me play that back to you, because I mean, and it's a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I think it's a really interesting one, and one is going to be helpful to our members again, because they're standing up, you know, I'll call them these black box engines that are giving them answers again, whether it's revenue forecasting, whether it's, you know, a customer that is not adopting at risk, whether it's whatever, right? And and let me just test, I want to play back the spectrum of, as you're standing up these models, there's one world, as you described with the cat pictures, where you're building a model and you know what the right answers needs to be. So again, let's say it's a tech support engine. You know what the right answer is. You can make sure your model's coming up with the right answer, and then it starts to get smarter and generalized. But you have the bumper there because you know what's correct and what's incorrect. That's one world, and the AI
right.
model can start to basically, you know, do that for the customer directly. You have faith it's doing the right thing. The other end of the spectrum, and I'll pick on something like renewal revenue forecasting, is you stand up a model, you start to train it, and it may go beyond, be smarter and come out with the answers, and you're not quite sure, like, but it's just smarter, and it's actually month after month, quarter after quarter, it's more accurate than anything I ever had before, and I'm super happy about that. I'm not exactly sure why. I don't really care, right? Because all right. I know, right? And then there's a place in between that where you're saying, well, look, there's models where they're actually getting smarter. Initially, I may not know why, but I've got to be able to decompose that. I've got to be able to go back because I've got to be able to justify that. Did I get that right? Is that sort of the three flavors?
Largely. You're okay. Definitely in the right ballpark. The explainability element, both on the cat photo example or, you know, recognizing photos, or let's say, you know, supply, demand, sales forecasting, both of those could be developed without explainability. So you could have a model that's doing supply demand forecasting, but it can't tell you why. It's incredibly accurate, but you don't know why.
And you may be okay with that. The whole point is you're like, hey, I don't really need to know why. All I know is it's super accurate.
That's exactly right. And really the main distinction most people need to deal with these days is if you don't have to know why, if explainability is not critical, it just opens up your options. One of the reasons, though, that people need to be very thoughtful is you may not know ahead of time. Within the healthcare space, regulation, it is incredibly important. I could talk about that quite a bit. Within the financial system, there are areas where explainability is not optional. The vast majority of use cases, it doesn't really matter, though, because as long as you have a system that is highly, highly accurate, it's just like our human brain. We may not understand how we recognize speech and how we convert audio signals into concepts in our brain. And that's okay. We can live with that because we can do it effectively and we can do it accurately. That's kind of where we are with AI right now. Yeah.
Well, and I'll just, you know, just to put a, you know, a dot on this, the AI here, I literally was just reading an article about how there was an AI model that Apple, when they initially did their credit card, put out there. And you probably know the story very well. And it was giving different credit limits to men and women, including Wozniak, who, you know, he had applied or whatever, and he got one limit, which is higher than his wife, right? They're in the same household, and they could not defend it. They didn't know why. They, you know, got rid of the algorithm or whatever. And I think to your point, I mean, that is where, as we get our sea legs as a society around AI, I think people are going to get more sensitive to the fact that, especially, you know, I'm an enterprise and I'm rolling this out, on the use cases where I better be able to look somebody in the eye and say, this is why the answer, you've got to basically go do that homework. Again, there's other internal, you know, models, stuff. It doesn't matter, and it's going to be fine. And what I heard you say, which is important, is if you don't have to decompose it, then it opens up flexibility in terms of the, you know, the models and what you're doing. When you do have to actually defend it and be able to, then it limits you a little bit in terms of.
You 100%. I couldn't agree more. And you also brought up, I think, something that is very, very important that's kind of been sort of hovering around this conversation, which is bias and ethics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for example, that loan model that was developed for some reason, and they weren't able to justify it, was giving women lower limits
right.
than men within the same household. And here's a real common misconception about AI, is that it doesn't have bias. That model, that loan decisioning model, like any AI model that is built using supervised learning, will have as much bias as in the data set. So if you take, let's take a concrete example. You want to go build a house valuation system.
Yep.
And you're going to go train it on 100 years of data. If that data is ethically, ethnically, or racially biased in any way, that model will learn it and it will pick up on that and it will perpetrate it. It is critical that people recognize this. You can take that bias out of the data set. There are all kinds of things other than just deleting the data. You can actually correct for it, like we mentioned about the breast cancer risk prediction model. But what you can't do is go train it on a bunch of historical data that has, you know, let's say racial bias in it, deploy that model in the real world, and then just throw your hands up and say, oh, well, the AI made the decision and it's just colorblind.
Yeah.
So anything it does is not biased. No, you train that model yep. to be as, you know, racist as that historic data set. And so what's one of the reasons explainability can be so important, because if you don't understand how the decisions are being made and you haven't done the work to understand the inherent bias within your data set, you were just going to perpetrate that out into the real world. Yeah.
So this is, I think, an important thread, because one question that we are starting to get from our member companies is, again, because we're not the you know, deployment and engineering experts that you guys are, but our job is to help our member companies understand how this is evolving, what use cases make sense, and make sure that they're, you know, leveraging it to its full impact within their business models, right? Now, one of the questions that's starting to come up is people are saying, well, you know, what do you guys have on the ethical deployment of AI? And I said, look, that's not what we're doing, you know, as researching as a company, but I want to test this with you because I think it's really important. Because what you're describing of this issue of bias is A, it's obviously real. It creates ethical issues. So if you're going to use AI to determine who gets a loan or who, you know, whatever, you know, there are ethical implications there, right? But
yes.
I'm curious, there is this line of demarcation between sort of what I'll call B2C type of or consumer direct interactions with AI models versus internal B2B stuff. So again, if I'm predicting my quarterly revenues using AI, I don't think there's a big ethical dilemma there. I'm predicting
right.
revenue. If I am determining my supply chain allocations, I don't see ethical. So I think that there's a firm line there. And I would say if you're not talking about using AI to make a decision that's going to impact an individual, right? And you're using it to make business decisions that are around numbers or revenues or parts allocations or all that kind of fun stuff, you know, I don't see the ethics issue in play there. But you, again, you're looking at a lot of use cases. What's your perspective here?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's like any part of life. There are situations where ethics are more important than in other situations, healthcare,
yeah.
financial systems, things like that. Yeah. If you're building a system to, you know, I don't know, extract information from a document and store it in a database so that you are eliminating hand transcriptions and things like that, any bias that exists is just going to be a transcription bias. It's yeah. not really going to affect yeah. people's lives yeah. or health or things
right.
like that. And so really the reason I'm so passionate about bringing up ethics is just because so many people have this, a little bit of this sort of false conception that AI couldn't possibly be biased or it's infallible or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's not the case.
Yep.
It's very, very fallible. And it's only as good as the data set it's trained on.
Yeah. So for our members, I mean, if you're using AI for human resource applications, you know, hirings, you know, whatever, evaluate, all that kind of, there are there are ethical implications there. You're making decisions that are impacting it. But if you're, so this is a great little rabbit trail there. I'm going to get us back to, you know, sort of these B2B use cases, mm-hmm. because that's mostly our audience. And again, what I opened up with here on this episode is the fact that we already in our research do see this gap between where AI just has killer use cases for an enterprise, just, you know, saving all kind of time, all kind of energy. We document those, we talk about those, you know, on webinars and at our conferences. But then we see this lag of companies actually leaning into it and taking advantage of these use cases. And I'm curious, as you're working, you know, with your customers, and ones that are enterprise oriented, why do you feel that they're not already aggressively deploying AI, you know, in a more ubiquitous way? What are the friction points there?
I think there are a lot of factors. One is most businesses are very much focused on the day-to-day, right? You know, they don't wake up every day and say, hey, is there some technology revolution happening that is going to disrupt the world that I need to think about today? Most of the time, they're just focused on running their business.
Yeah.
Another part of it is, you know, the press likes to hype things. I mean, just think about the cryptocurrency, you know, wave and different opinions there, you know, felt a lot like a Ponzi scheme to me. And so now everybody's excited about AI, and this is not a new technology. Haven't we heard this before? So you may not know how much to pay attention to it, right? You may just sort of have like tech hype fatigue in general. And then somebody comes to you and they say, oh, actually, you're going to go out of business if you don't get on this AI hype train. And it can just be exhausting. The reality is, it is real. It is maturing at a pace that I think would shock most people. We could talk about the things that are happening in the industry on a weekly basis that would just blow people's minds. In fact, it's happening so fast. This is crazy. All we do is AI. And about 2 years ago, we found ourselves kind of exhausted because me and the rest of the engineering team, we'd work hard all week. And then in the evenings, we would have to take time off to read white papers, or we'd have to, you know, do prototypes on the weekend. It was just burning us out. And we made a decision 2 years ago to carve out Fridays. And 20% of our time now is dedicated to ongoing learning. So we don't do any client billing on Fridays now. All we do are, we have white paper sessions, we have guest lectures, we do prototyping together. We have to do it as experts and professionals in the field because it's moving so damn fast, we can't keep up with it. And so what I would say to business leaders out there who are trying to figure out what to do, don't ignore it. It's not going away. If you ignore it, your competitors are not. But it also doesn't mean you have to go crazy and do a moonshot right out of the gate. We are big advocates of starting with something like an AI strategy roadmap to understand what your opportunities are and to have your first project, maybe your first two or three projects, be relatively achievable, low risk, high return. And when we say high return, we mean at least 10x ROI. And because most companies haven't done anything, there's tons of low-hanging fruit. You don't have to go try to build a time machine out of the gate. You can do things like demand forecasting, supply chain optimization, help desk support, document processing, fraud detection, product recommendations, on and on and on. Almost all of these apply to any company, and they are relatively low risk at this point in time because the technology has matured so much. Once you get one of those or two under your belt and you have some success, we see this over and over again. The companies become much, much more confident about their own ability to deploy AI capabilities, and then they're kind of off to the races. Yep. And so don't ignore it, but don't also try to hit a grand slam at your first at bat. Take a slow approach that's focused on ROI.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said, 1,000%. And just to build on it, this fatigue thing I see as well, right? And people are like, yeah, I don't know how much is hype. And the business press on this is, you know, schizophrenic, as you're probably more aware of than I am. But all the regs that I read, it's like on one day, oh my God, AI. But then, you know, the next day I'll be like, well, it's, you know, the Wall Street Journal will have an article. It's unclear what the ROI is for our AI. And they'll interview somebody who says, oh, we deployed Copilot to all of our employees. And I don't know what it's like they're missing the point, right? So my bigger fear is that companies aren't jumping on the hobby horse here and getting experience. And I think that what you just said is spot on, which is if you're new to this game, There are a lot of proven use cases. Pick one or two that is not rocket science, not a moonshot. Yep. Deploy it, see how it works, see what it takes, you know, move on to your next. And I'll just tell you this, I think you'll find this interesting. We just had our conference in Vegas and we did this executive session. So we had about 40 executives in there, all on this topic. What are you doing on AI? How are you deploying? Testing on what the friction points are. And one of the interesting things that's now emerging for the companies, and of course, these are all tech companies, right? So for the companies that now have deployed, you know, one, two, three, maybe more use cases, the thing that they're starting to realize is now they have a bunch of pilots, and what they don't have is an overarching vision and strategy on where they're taking AI. So that's sort of the next frontier. And so everybody listening saying, hey, we're past this initial hurdle. The next one you got to get your arms around is saying, okay, but we don't need 1,000 points of light here. We don't need, you know, 100 different pilots that are all going in different directions and using different technologies. And there is no overarching frame. And I'm curious if you're starting to see that with some of your more advanced customers that have gotten over those first initial pilots. Are they starting to realize that, hey, I actually probably need an overarching strategy here?
Yes, it's exactly what we're seeing. You know, if you go back, let's say the first 5 years we were a business, most of the people we dealt with were early adopters, right? This is pre-ChatGPT. So they would come to us and they would have a question like, would it be possible to solve, you know, this type of problem using AI? And the answer was almost always yes. Post-ChatGPT, there was a little bit of a rush to deploy generative AI solutions because people used ChatGPT.
You're like, hey, this is cool.
It was so powerful.
Yeah, this is so powerful.
It was so cool. Yeah. It was so easy to use. But the challenge there is that generative AI, as powerful as it is also more unwieldy. What most of those people fail to, you know, kind of reflect on is you didn't use exactly what ChatGPT gave you for an answer, right? You evaluated or you would iterate on it and interact with it. And that is still largely necessary within generative AI right now. We had a client come to us the other day. They said they've built 200 prototypes over the last 2 years and haven't gotten any of them into production. And one of my big sort of mantras recently is generative AI is one type of AI. And people need to remember that. Domain-specific AI, like a lot of the things we've talked about today, are related, but much, much more suited at this stage in time for businesses, because these sort of domain-specific narrow AIs can do one thing, and they can do it at a human or superhuman level, but they don't have the risks and the complexity of deploying generative AI solutions in production. So if you're a business that is considering taking your first step into AI, unless you're doing something like help desk chatbots, which are really powerful, or some type of RAG-based internal knowledge system. And RAG is an acronym for retrieval augmented generation, where you can ask a system questions, but it's not just using its training to answer it. It's actually referencing documents in real time to make sure it has full context. Aside from those two approaches, most businesses are going to be much, much better suited with a domain-specific solution that solves a narrow problem at a very, very high level. They're less expensive and they're more reliable.
Yeah. So I'm going to test this with you because over the last 6 months, we spent time researching AI use cases specifically for revenue generation workflows. Because what we were seeing in our research is that, you know, if you look at a support organization and they're using AI on their portal and they have chatbots and stuff, that was becoming very mature. Education services using AI, they put all their product information in, they use it to generate training materials, right? Great use case.
Right.
But the sales and marketing teams were lagging. And as we looked at that and we did case studies and, you know, again, what's working, what's not, we sort of created the staircase to success here in terms of how to deploy. Now, again, I want to test this with you, playing back what you said. What we found is the easiest, lowest hanging fruit was a Gen AI, but Gen AI models that are small language models informed by your specific offer information, not the world, you know, not general ChatGPT. And you say, look, put your content in here to help generate proposals, to help respond to RFPs, to help create emails for your salespeople. Super easy to do, saves tons of hours from sales and marketing people. Next click up are these, you know, more machine learning models that are around revenue prediction models, take a little bit more time to tune. you know, big bang for the buck, right? Then you can go to, you know, recommendation engines and other stuff. But those were the first two building blocks, which again, it's really about leveraging your particular content with your team. So does that resonate with you in terms of how to get, you know, like sales and marketing teams started?
100%. And that's exactly aligned with what we're seeing with our
thank God. Oh my God, that was a risky question to ask there, folks. But
I'm so glad you nailed that one. Yeah, because it's the easiest. This comes full loop. You know, we're talking about the proprietary data sets that every business has. Yeah. The one that's the easiest to access are the ones that are sort of document based.
Yeah.
You can throw them into some type of RAG system and use them as knowledge retrieval. A great example is we work with clients, they'll say, take all the contracts we've already signed and put them in a system. And then you can ask it questions like, do we have any contracts where we've agreed to terms this? Or do we have any contracts that have risky clauses associated with them that maybe we just don't even know about? And many, many other systems like that where you're leveraging your own data and querying it. And the nice thing about this, again, it comes back to what we were talking about a second ago, is you have a human in the loop. A human's looking at the answers. They can vet it. They can check it. You're not taking that output and directly sending it to your clients unfiltered.
Yeah. You know, I can tell you, technology companies spend so much time and treasure responding to RFPs, reviewing contracts. It's tons of people, and using AI to accelerate that, right, is a tool that people can use to quickly get to the right answers is huge. And I want to talk about time and treasure in general. So I know there's lots of variance. People knock on your door, they have a project, they want to get started. But give people a sense, and again, we're not talking about moonshots here, right? But when they come and say, hey, I want to apply AI in a reasonable use case, what are your experience in terms of how long it takes them to go from, you know, I can't spell AI, but I want to deploy this, you know, use case to actually start to get some benefit from it?
Right. We typically recommend one or two approaches. If you are really just starting from scratch, we typically counsel don't add AI features right away. And the reason is we saw over the years that a lot of companies, especially in our first 5 years when I was saying we were dealing with early adopters, they would have an idea. It would totally be feasible. We would go build it. But about halfway through building it, we would realize, oh my gosh, you know, there are like 20 other use cases that would have cost less money and delivered more ROI. Yeah. So if you're really, really starting from scratch, start with some type of strategy. Develop an approach. Look at your business holistically, at least to some degree, so that you can develop strong ROI use cases behind the different initiatives. And then, like we already talked about, start relatively small. Don't swing for the fences too much right out of the gate. And by that, we mean typically do projects that are going to be in the order of 3 to 4 months. And that is to production. That means training, development, build out, integration, everything. And that's beautiful because that means that, you know, the executive team and the leadership can have sort of proof of life and confidence within a couple of quarters. Yeah. And that, as I mentioned earlier, really changes things. And then if you want to take on things that might take a year or two, great. But smaller opportunities right now and less risky, higher ROI projects are our go-to and what we recommend for all of our clients.
Yeah. And I think what's so interesting about that, having been in enterprise technology for a long time, is I think one of the things that's very different about it, deploying AI, is if you think about historically, you say, hey, man, we need a new ERP system. Oh my God, this is going to be so painful. And we got to like get all our specs and then we got to roll it out and we got to train people. And we were supposed to get this theoretical ROI and it's 2 years later and I'm not even sure if it's really saving us any money. That's the history of enterprise software, by the way, right there. A lot of complexity, long time to get to an ROI. And AI is different because, and I see it because I've interviewed enough of our members with these use cases and they all basically say the same thing you did, which is this is not 2 years to ROI. This is 3 to 6 months. You can deploy this software and this capability, and you can see real business impact, real time savings, real whatever, in right before your eyes. And it is a game changer for that reason. You know, it's just a very different experience.
I completely agree. And if you follow sort of industry best practices, it's very much sort of taking the best lessons learned over the last, I'd say, 20 years from software And what you can do is you can develop these AI models and you can containerize them. You can put a light RESTful API on top of them. You can make them stateless and horizontally scalable. And then the beautiful thing about that is you can have this new capability integrated within your infrastructure, cloud agnostic, and then serve it up. If it's a prediction capability, you can serve it up real time. You can queue up batch jobs. You can really do anything you want to. And it doesn't require, like you said, deploying like a new ERP system or something right. crazy like that. It's almost like deploying a new software capability that is producing output that's being consumed by downstream software or people. And that makes it so much, much less risky. And it also means you don't end up in a situation, like you said, where it's like years of development, and you're kind of boiling the ocean. They really can be bite-sized.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, these are, you know, super interesting times. And I really appreciate you stopping in and giving your perspective on this. Cause again, I love talking to people like you who have real battle scars with folks on this, and it's not hype and you're not sitting here saying AI is, you know, all these things. I mean, it's really these very practical use cases that make a real difference in people's businesses and their personal lives. I mean, I think it's really an exciting time. I'm happy that I'm alive and getting a chance to see this thing unfold. And I didn't study this stuff like you did. So I bet you're really happy that the winter's over. Spring is here.
I've said this before. Sometimes I feel like Rip Van Winkle, right? Yeah. You know, I woke up and all of a sudden AI is back and it's working again. And at the end of the day, it's just software. It's really, really powerful. It's a new technology, but it's just software. And I really think it's going to change our world for the better in ways that are almost unpredictable at this point.
Oh, I think so too. I think so too. Well, again, thanks for coming in. I always end these sessions with a question of the day. And my question of the day here for folks, how many guests do I have to have on Tectonic before you are convinced this AI thing isn't a passing fad? Cheers, everybody.